Good day, everyone. My name's Christine, president for South Dakota Auto Dealers Association. Welcome to the official Driveline podcast of South Dakota Auto Dealers and South Dakota Trucking Associations. Today, I'm excited to introduce to you Kevin Tynan. He is a director of research with the Presudio Group. Welcome, Kevin. Thanks for joining me today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I got to know Kevin a couple years ago through other ATAEs and seen you on CBT News. I've seen you presenting all over the place. And I just remember meeting you for the first time. I'm like, that guy is wicked smart. He knows his stuff. He knows the industry. And so having you on our podcast today is quite the honor. Thank you so much. I know this is going to be your favorite one. You do a lot, but South Dakota is where it's at. So
very exciting. First one. I'm honored that you invited me to this and to convention. It's going to be great.
Yeah, well, welcome. So, Kevin, your background, you've been all over, director of research, you know the industry. DC's wild right now. As fast as this podcast is over, there could be new changes. And so we have to pivot. This is the era of pivot, pivot. Don't freak out too soon. And kind of that wait and see approach. What are you seeing from your end as far as kind of the state of the industry and what car dealers are experiencing right now?
Yeah, well, two things, Christine. One is what you see today, especially in the first quarter, including March, in terms of sales volume, demand is going to be very, very different than what you see probably even in April and through the summer and maybe even to the end of the year. So, you know, as I speak with dealers, I'm saying like, hey, don't get caught up in this moment because it's going to be very different very soon. But at the same time, I think a lot of it is going to be it's going to be good in a way, in a sort of contrarian way, that the pandemic was good. Right. And what I mean by that is that the pandemic was supply constraint for the U.S. auto industry, meaning you had people isolated, you had businesses, everything closed. And to put that in context, and I watch production every month, all the North America, U.S. factories. April of 2020, right? We all got sent home. I remember right after St. Patrick's Day of 2020, we got sent home from the office. And looking at the April 2020 North America production, there was like 4,000 vehicles built. Normally, there would be 1.5 million built in North America. Yeah. There was 4,000. So one difference is it stopped for everybody, right? There was supply chain disruption globally for every manufacturer in every region, every country. This is supply chain and supply disruption constraint just in the form of tariff. So we've been actually calling it a tariff pandemic. It's a similar effect. The difference is, and it is more than subtle, is that it doesn't affect every manufacturer the same, right? Depending where your production footprint is going to matter on how many units you sell in the US or can or can't produce or send here. So, but that said, if this is supply constraint, which is what it looks like, when you go back to 2020 and then roll through 21 and into 2022, for the franchise dealer base, 2022 was the most profitable year in history. Right. And it was only a 13.8 million total unit market on the new vehicle side, right? So 2024 was 16 million and it was way less profitable than 2022 was. So my point is, if you just follow the evidence and say, this is a supply constrained industry, probably for the next, at least through this year, we will eventually get to that supply demand balance that drives prices more firm and widens margins and drives profitability higher. So, better to be a franchise dealer in this environment than it is to be a manufacturer who has to think about their production footprint, where you produce, where you can sell. And I feel like the franchise dealer base kind of went through this cost rationalization to get a little bit smaller during the pandemic, right, and be profitable in a 13.8 million unit market. So I think there's a little bit less work to do on the cost side for the franchise dealers than there is for the manufacturers.
Right. And we know car dealers are resilient. They've been through a lot, whether it's been the market crashing or tariffs or a pandemic. Car dealers are certainly resilient in that area. Talk to me a little bit about, American made versus non-American made. So, for example, I understand that pieces of every car come from overseas. There's not 100% made in the USA. Things are shipped over, and those vehicles are put together, so to speak, in the manufacturer then from some of those pieces that are coming over. How does that impact the price of those vehicles, or what would we see based on each maybe brand? Are some going to be hurt more than others?
Absolutely. But everything, tariffs are inflationary, full stop, right? And you're right. So final assembly may be in the United States. It may be in Canada, Mexico. And under the USMCA, then tariffs are only on the parts that are not from the US. And that could be anywhere from, I think the highest US content is like a EV out of Hyundai Kia, EV9 or EV6. And it's 80%. Right. So even everybody talks about Tesla, the most American made vehicle, it's only 75% parts are US. So you're still going to have, let's say, 25% on 20% of the parts. Right. So it's just inflationary. The price of everything is going higher. That's not necessarily the administration's concern here. The concern is jobs, create manufacturing here. So let me put it in context. 2024, as we said, was 16 million vehicles, new vehicles sold in the US. About 11 million of them were produced in the US. So that leaves 5 million vehicles, whether that's Canada, Mexico, or imported from another country, that what I would call are in play, may or may not get built, but there's about 5 million units on the table there. So probably not enough at 11 million to be profitable here, but if you think about this, North America, or not even North America, U.S. automotive factories in the fourth quarter ran at 65% capacity utilization. There's the potential to increase output from our domestic factories. And almost every manufacturer has at least truck capacity here. Not all of it may be UAW. Some of it's right to work in the South, Mercedes in Alabama or BMW in South Carolina. But there is capacity here that can absorb some of those missing 5 million units. And then if you go back to the idea that 2022 at 13.8 was very profitable, we're close, right?
Yeah.
So in theory, on paper, this can all work in the favor of the manufacturers who already have their production footprint here. And for the retailers, like I said, that really tightens that supply and demand balance. And, from the end of 21 through the end of 22, we saw above MSRP, we saw the widest margins, the most profit per rooftop in history. And it can be that kind of situation again. The consumer and the media will talk about rising prices and we can't afford anything. I'm just saying there's always somebody on the other side of that trade. Right. Which in this case would be the retailers and the manufacturers, that artificially or not, that supply-demand balance drives prices higher, it drives margins wider.
Right, right. And that's a great point. And just a, segue into, supply and demand, EVs. Let's talk EVs. I've heard you give a talk a while back about kind of the EV credits and some of that. We don't have to go into all that detail by any means, but supply and demand. South Dakota probably is one of the lowest adoption rates for many reasons. There's a lot of range anxiety. We don't really have the infrastructure here. It's
not many
wide open.
Do.
Yeah, right. But it's wide open spaces in South Dakota. And an EV might be a nice luxury vehicle, but you're not going to see an EV pickup hauling a boat or a horse trailer, because you're not going to probably make it to the lake here in South Dakota. But talk a little bit about the EV and the changing landscape, maybe in DC, and what the state of the industry is really for what's next for electric vehicles.
Yeah, and I think when you pare it all back into its basic form, it's the creation of an unnatural marketplace, right? And that's not to say that EVs are good or bad, in a single brush. It depends, right? And what works in New York City or in California might not work in South Dakota or in New Jersey or Texas. So the thing is, when you have government sort of step in and say, you need to do this to this degree by this date, it creates what I'd call an unnatural marketplace. And those are very difficult, right? Because there's so many inputs and conditions that can change. And it just all of a sudden goes from making sense to making no sense. And we deal with it here, and I live in New Jersey, and we had a CARB waiver. And essentially, as a consumer, I'm thinking, first, I don't want you to tell me what I can buy and can't buy this year or in 2035. And the other thing I'm thinking is, why is California deciding what I can buy and can't buy in 2035 or in
In another state.
2027?
Yeah, in another state.
Right, in another state. So I think when I look at it, and really from an analyst's perspective, if that organic demand isn't there, you can force it a little bit, but ultimately, and as being a finance guy, I look at it this way. If you want EV adoption and you want to force it as the government, you have to make the manufacturer whole. Giving demand levers to the consumer doesn't make sense. And here's the way I lay it out, right? Like, let's say, for example, you're a consumer and the government tells you, or you decide you want an EV, and there's a federal tax credit or a rebate or whatever. There's money on the table for you to get an EV. And you say, great, okay, I'll get an EV. And then the government steps in and says, by the way, Christine, we're going to invest trillions of dollars and we're going to put charging infrastructure on every corner. Don't worry about your range anxiety. You won't go 10 feet without a charger. And now I'm a manufacturer and I realize the drivetrain technology is not profitable. So I'm going to lose $15,000 by selling you this EV, multiplied by however many people want them. What happens? I don't build it. So you can have all the demand in the world. The government can artificially create demand. They can even invest in the infrastructure. But if me, the manufacturer, isn't made whole, I just don't build it. And that's why adoption rates have been slower than expected in this country, because compared to China, and I did this analysis also, China has contributed about $250 billion to their EV industry over the past since 2009. And when you look at the numbers, that's about $18,000 per vehicle in direct subsidies, which we wouldn't do here. Our government wouldn't go to GM or Ford and say, hey, we know you're losing money on that. Here's 18,000. Meanwhile, we're losing programs in schools and our roads are falling apart and all these other things. Never going to happen. So what you do is you offer money to the consumer, and then you tell the automaker, like, hey, raise your price by that amount, and we'll kind of launder the money through the consumer to you. So that it's just this very unnatural situation. And I think what a lot of the CARB states, when you look at it, the mix of sales needs to go to 43% in 2027, all the way to 100% by 2035. And if you take New Jersey, for example, we're about 8% EV penetration now in 2024. So by 2027, we got to go from 8 to 43. How? Right? Now, the problem there is that if you're a manufacturer and you have to deliver a 43-57 mix, but I can only send a couple of thousand EVs, and that's where the organic demand is. What happens? My total volume in New Jersey, and let's call it 500,000 units, becomes about 200,000 units. And those 300,000 units are going to go to my 200-mile border with Pennsylvania, where for me is 30 minutes to just jump over the border and go to New Hope or Doylestown and pick up a vehicle that I actually want to buy and
To
own.
purchase, yeah.
So So as we get to these sort of next round of elections, I think a lot of the CARB states have a lot to think about whether you want that waiver or not. Because to me, it's a binary bet. If you're the manufacturer, either you're going to look at New Jersey's 500,000 units and say, we don't want to walk away from that, but there's no way we're getting to 43%. We'll pay the fine or we'll pass it along to those New Jersey consumers or to consumers everywhere. Or I'm gonna stay true to that 43%, and that means total volume is gonna decline. Either way, New Jersey kind of loses, right? It either loses total volume, or the manufacturers pass along the cost of not being compliant. So crazy,
It is.
big mess, but there's a lot to unpack.
So what happens though in 2035? I mean, a lot of the legacy brands have said 2035, we're 100% EV. How does that happen? And how do they pivot? Being an ATAE, we talk to all the brands and things of that nature, and some do it a little different than others. We certainly recognize that, but we're not seeing anybody coming out saying, hey, we're ditching this plan. Here's the new plan. It's still kind of just lingering out there. And, I've reached out to a few of the brands that pull us in for meetings and say, what is the new plan? What are you going to do? And what should
Well,
our franchise dealers expect coming from you? Because look, let's be honest, if the consumer comes in and they want a red wagon, we'll sell them a red wagon. Whatever the consumer wants, we'll sell it. And so we want the option as dealers to sell it. And so 2035 comes, and some of the legacy brands are saying, we're only going to sell EV. How? How?
no, and if you think about that, and I do a lot. One thing that I think is, imagine what 10 years is in the life of a CEO, right? So when I think like what Mary Barra or Jim Farley is saying today, and where they'll be 10 years from now, it's probably, on the beach in Cartagena somewhere, and it's not going to be their problem. But I also think you can walk back those things. I think as long as there's enough of a quorum where everybody's kind of moving in that direction and it becomes more acceptable to say, and look, Ford did this when Bill Ford was the CEO going back into sort of the turn of the century, which was they were the first fastest moving hybrid manufacturer in the US, and it eventually reached a point where he said, we can't sell things unprofitably forever. People have to want to buy them, and they have to want to buy them profitably. So they did walk it back. That was before Alan Mulally stepped in. And you know what the crazy thing is, Christine, is that I think that the technology, be it gasoline hybrid, plug-in hybrid, full battery electric, right? That works for some people, some places, somewhere, just the way a sports car works for somebody and a minivan works for somebody else, right? That choice should be there, and I think it's legitimate. And I think that adoption happening organically and naturally would be fine. I think it's the problem when you step in and force it and you say things like we're 100% EV by 2035. And the other thing I would say about that, Christine, is that and you got to remember that the environment and the conditions financially at the time. You had Tesla market cap, its valuation going crazy. No matter what that guy said, at the time he was able to show quarter over quarter, year over year, just exorbitant growth rate. The stock is worth 100 times its multiple, is way higher than anybody else's. And it was frustrating for other CEOs who are thinking like, we have as much, if not more, technology than that company. We have more manufacturing. We are global. All these things that didn't make sense to CEOs. And it was kind of like, well, if it just comes down to saying stupid EV things and having the market react to it, we can probably do that without trying, right? Like, so, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to produce all these EVs. And then you're kind of waiting to see your stock price pop. And it did for a little bit. By the end of 22, that was over, though,
Right.
or by the beginning of 22, the end of 21. So I think you had CEOs saying things that they didn't really think they would have to deliver on at any point.
Right.
Look at GM, right? You have Hamtramck, which was a small car factory, and they're like, oh, we got this empty factory, let's make it an EV factory. And then you turn around and wait for the market to go like, oh, thank goodness. So I think there things were said that you're sort of just kicking it down the road a little bit and hoping it kind of goes away, and it
Catches
didn't.
up or
Yeah,
whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
and now you got to stand and deliver. But at the end of the day, for a CEO to come back and say, "Yeah, we're not going to do that," isn't the end of the world. They probably do that all the time, right? You know,
Right, right.
you have to make hard decisions and say difficult things, reduce headcount, close plants. But on the because people will always say that to me. But look at all the billions that have been invested, and I'm saying, factories close all the time. Since the beginning of time, automakers have closed factories, but you can't continue to throw good money after bad forever, right? You
Right.
can't just say,
You can only
well,
keep
we
afloat
invested,
for so long.
we invested this much, we might as well waste more. Like, that doesn't make sense either, right? You
No.
gotta cut the line at some point.
Right. So what would be your message in this not political, maybe political climate, but with all that you've seen over your career and your path, the pit, I just pivot is just the word that just keeps coming to mind. We have to pivot. We have to make sure that we're paying attention to what's going on, but also stay cool, calm, and collected. What are, with your time over the last however many years, what's your
Well, two
best advice
things.
or what are you seeing?
Yeah, two things I would say. One is that pivot is a very, very good point, especially for the franchise dealer base, right? And one thing that, and this goes back to my stock picking days in the late 90s
Yeah.
on Wall Street, which is the beauty of the franchise dealer base is revenue diversity, right? So if you get in a market where, it's oversupply and there's no margin on the new vehicle side, you say, you know what? We have used vehicle operations here. We have parts counters. We have service bays. We have an F&I desk. Like, there's other ways to generate revenue and earnings that, to give you an example, like a CarMax or a Carvana doesn't, right? They're only doing used vehicles. If that market's
Right.
bad, the only way out is through, right? You just got to ride it out.
Yep.
And I think this is kind of what happened heading into the pandemic period or before the pandemic, which was new vehicle full line legacy franchise dealers would see really low front end gross on new vehicles and go, you know what? I'm banging my head against the wall with these manufacturing partners. Meanwhile, I can get significantly higher margins in the pre-owned market. And I honestly believe that's how Carvana was created in the first place.
Right, yeah.
CarMax was kind of playing in the sandbox by themselves, and as an analyst, you knew their margin on retail and on wholesale every quarter, right? It was just like clockwork. And Carvana goes, well, hey, and we have a saying around Presidio, which is your margin is my opportunity. And so I think a lot of dealers said, you know what, we'll do some of the new stuff, but let's go focus over here. And you saw these big, private label and separate pre-owned stores, AutoNation, all these things.
Yeah.
And then that goes bad, and the pandemic supply demand balance or supply
Yeah.
constraint. Now you're seeing double digits on your new vehicle front end, and you're going like, "Hey, used market, forget you. We'll be back over here doing this," which you, Carvana, CarMax can't do,
Nope,
right?
they don't have the option.
And then you talk about the 50, 60% gross margin in fixed ops, and you're going like, "Hey, that's something we can do that nobody else can do. Let's focus a little bit more there." So yeah, that pivot and that flexibility is a beauty of the franchise dealer base. And when you're good at it and you can see ahead, you're ready for this kind of disruption and prepared for it. The couple other things that I would tell the franchise dealer base is one, expect that it's going to be a smaller total new vehicle market, right? It's
Yep.
supply constrained, not all bad, stronger pricing, maybe wider margins, but don't be planning, the way 2009, the global financial crisis happened, and we build back up to 17 million units, right? The pandemic comes, and new vehicle volume craters, and then we're back up to 16 million. And now here we're going to get knocked back again. Like, I wouldn't be, I think organically and healthy, and the pandemic showed this, is about that 15 million unit market, right? 15.5 would be, and it's a, and I tell people, look, compare 15.5 to 17.5, 15.5 more profitable. Way easier to find 15.5 than it is 17, right? You've got to pull 2 million buyers off the sideline with money, with incentives, giving away your margin to be able to do it. So be happy with that slightly smaller, but more bang for the buck kind of market there. So, and then the other thing is, I think this very near term is going to look very different than the long term. And what you need to do is, these supply demand lessons, driving price, driving margin, have been in place forever. It's since the beginning of trading, supply and demand has had the same impact on markets. And don't ignore that, right? And so if this is a supply constrained market, you can really look back very recently to the lessons you learned through the pandemic and say, these are probably going to apply now. And I remember, I read a lot, and I just was reading Lee Iacocca's book, and he's taught, there's a book written in 1984, published in 1984, and he's talking about the impact of the supply and demand balance being tight post World War II, right? So these are like 70-year lessons that he's writing about 40 plus years ago that still hold today, so don't it's not different this time. It's those lessons have been learned and written down, and you just need to pay attention to them and keep your head, and you'll be fine with it. So,
The
there's
playbook has been
these
kind of
external.
written and is there for people to work through it.
And the good thing for the franchise base and the industry overall is, like, we just went through this, like, this, this
Very
isn't this.
recent.
Yeah, this isn't 20 years ago or two generations of car
Exactly.
dealers that don't know how to handle supply and demand balance. So, this is like last semester's textbook. Dust it off, and the lessons are in there.
I love it. I love it. Well, I appreciate all the lessons. I always feel like I get so much smarter talking to you. I'm writing my notes, so if I'm looking down, it's because I'm like, oh, that's a good nugget. That's a good thing. I always learn so much from just chatting with you, and your industry knowledge is like nobody else. And so, a treat to have you on today, and especially excited to have you at our convention and just a couple of weeks as well, and welcome you to the beautiful Black Hills.
Very much looking forward to that. You have no idea how excited I am.
It will be great. It will. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you to all of our listeners. Stay tuned to our next episode coming up shortly. But again, Kevin, thank you for your experience and your expertise in the automotive industry. Lots of change, lots more to come. Don't freak out. Just pivot. And we'll be okay as we work through the playbook that's been written. So thank you, Kevin.
My pleasure.